this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Well, the most important effect for the continent is, again, on food and fertilizers. The food price is already going up, but with the gas prices going up and actually availability problem.
University of Johannesburg political economist Patrick Bond explains the effect of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran on the economy of South Africa and other African countries.
The resolution passed by John Mahama Dramani is a very important element, a moment in the history of Africa, in the history of the world, and the history of Africanese people.
A historic UN General Assembly resolution urges member states to apologize for slavery and supports the establishment of a reparations framework to address long-lasting, deep-seated racial injustice.
The United States has not been able to find a staunch ally, neither in the Turkish government nor in the Kurdish opposition.
A former member of the Turkish parliament speaks about the role of Turkey in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilia. The U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran and Lebanon has led to a growing economic catastrophe for the people of Africa. Patrick Bond is a political economist and professor at the University of Johannesburg. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the crisis in South Africa and other African countries as working people and the poor are indirect victims of this new U.S. war.
Well, I think the quick story is that the oil prices have increased dramatically across the continent, and there is a bit of rationing here in Johannesburg. About 150 of the petrol stations have gone dry. They haven't had any either gas, regular liquid, or diesel. And then the next set of carry-ons will be no doubt the food prices, because fertilizer is terribly important. Even though we're going into the winter time here, there is still some winter crops that are grown, typically wheat. And then the general rise in prices will probably, from the U.S. side, if Kevin Warsh takes over the Fed and is as Milton Friedman oriented, that is, a monetarist, and convinced that if you can raise interest rates, you'll lower the inflation rate. And the inflation rate would be a threat to the economy in the U.S. in November. And hence, Warsh may say this is Wall Street's mandate. Trump, of course, would like the opposite, lower interest rates. And had he put Kevin Hassett in, that would have been the outcome. And then those interest rates, if they do come through to us in Africa, will then have a terrible impact on debt affordability. Many of the mineral prices are very fragile right now. So South Africa's done a great deal with gold. We still have a huge amount of gold. Below me was half the world's historic gold as recently as 1970. And so gold has stayed up. I mean, it was at 5,400 and it went down to 47. So it's, as the anticipated dollar strengthening occurs, there's less demand for gold. And then we'll see probably some of the pressures on the currency. We've already gone from 16 rand to the dollar to 17. What all this means, Steve, is multiple pressures, higher interest rates, and a very flat economy. Usually we're running about 1% growth. We have about 1.3% population growth. So what we're really looking at here is probably some tense times. And I think the overlap of what the Chinese have done with extraordinarily productive economies and major financial pushes from the state into manufacturing is to swamp our clothing and textiles recently, but the steel, the aluminium, the automobiles. So we're seeing massive imports that have displaced. And I think I'd blame Trump for that, because the Chinese did lose 20% of their market in the United States. So they're displacing that by exporting elsewhere. So that in turn has meant the trade unions, who are often pro-China and pro-BRICS, they're now saying, oh, we need actually strong tariffs. And the National Union of Metal Workers are the main example. So like, say, Sean Fain at the UAW promoting the Trump tariffs last April, without a sense of international labor solidarity, we probably will run into the same problem here. So it's quite a dire situation. And then, of course, we've got the traditional support for Israel from the big coal companies, Glencore and African Rainbow Minerals. And there's a big push this week to put in legal documents to the state and to the coal company, the export terminal, to try to stop those. There are about four ships. They carry about 170,000 tons of coal from Richards Bay to the two big Israeli power plants. And we get a sense that if the war continues, if Iran targets, say, the Haifa refinery or the offshore Leviathan gas field, well, Israel will need much more of the South African coal. And that's, of course, the big irony, the tragedy that Cyril Ramaphosa, himself a coal tycoon who was connected to Glencore, and his brother-in-law, Patrice Motsepe, who may well replace him as the president. There's a big move in that direction from the South African bourgeoisie and the chattering classes. Well, Glencore and African Rainbow Minerals are the main, the only, in fact, suppliers of coal to Israel now that the Colombians have stopped. All of these we put together and say there should be many opportunities in this context for us to really fight hard and raise our consciousness and build a big internationalist movement and fight the U.S. embassy and the consulates here in Johannesburg. But we haven't really got it up and running. But I think there are some better days ahead as we begin to consolidate all of these campaigns that I've mentioned.
And what is the position of the labor movement in South Africa and Africa in regard to the attack on Iran by Israel and the United States?
Well, there's a generally strong solidarity movement in principle, and there have been some pretty well attended protests, 500 or so at a time at the U.S. consulate here. And the metal workers have had, for example, a major defend Venezuela. So, of course, the next big solidaristic push here is for Cuba, because Cuba is so important to the South African, the Namibian, the Angolan struggles against the white South African army. The Cubans in 1988 helped the Angolans fend off white South Africa and did quite a few casualties. There were enough deaths in white South African army fatigues, and the coffins came back here, so that the pullback in 1989 from Angola, and then Namibia getting its independence in 1990, and then South Africa's independence in 1994, we can certainly attribute to Cuba to some substantial extent. And so there's an attempt to pull some of that solidarity. But, you know, these are mostly old timers who will do this, people like myself, who really can remember the incredible importance of Cuba. I think those are going to be the, let's say, terrains of solidarity. But we can't do much more than protest at the U.S. consulate. We haven't been able to put pressure on the South African government sufficiently, who are themselves quite frightened by the United States, for example, to do more to help Iran defend. And of course, then there's the other ambivalence, which is that the Iranian government's own attacks on its own protesters as recently as January, with thousands killed, also make people on the left rather wary. The unions are in and out of this, but they're suffering their own crises, and those include the deindustrialization. NUMSA, the metal workers, going down from about 350,000 to 280,000 members at present. So quite substantial hits to the industrial workforce, and most of the unions are really just staggering around, you know, quite punch drunk.
And one of the efforts of immigration to the United States that Trump has made, this fascist, racist president, is to bring in Afrikaners. I think everyone else from Africa, blacks and brown people, are being excluded, but Afrikaners have been given a welcome. And I understand that some of them recently have returned to South Africa, unhappy with their environment for them in the United States.
Yes, don't forget their enormous privileges over the years. Even though there have been some working class Afrikaners who've lost some of those privileges, and many, of course, who are state apparatchiks, they no longer can have civil service jobs as easily. But Afrikaners, and especially English-speaking whites, of course, are about traditionally about 3 million Afrikaners, 2 million English-speaking whites. Some of them have, taken a gap, and we don't really know how many there are because they leave without sort of saying. But let's say it's even 4 million instead of 5 million. The whites are still very much at the commanding heights of the economy, and even the middle-class whites, you know, have servants and swimming pools. So I think one of the crucial things is that this attempt to paint Afrikaners as being subject to genocide simply hasn't caught on, and only a few hundred actually went. And I think many of them, as you say, are having troubles. And it's to your point that the rest of the continent, the Black Africa, especially from, say, countries like Senegal, which won the African Cup of Nations, a bit of a controversy with Morocco about who actually holds that cup right now. But they can't send their citizens to the U.S. to celebrate the Senegalese in the World Cup and to do, you know, to cheer, because they have to pay a $15,000 bond. That is a sort of down payment to the U.S. embassy to say, hey, we are coming back. And, you know, $15,000 is a proof that we'll be coming back. So it's an extraordinary set of pure racist techniques from Marco Rubio and, the immigration authorities to say we don't want Black Africans, but those white Afrikaners who've had all the advantages in apartheid and are, yeah, by no means suffering any kind of genocide, well, they're still welcome. They were, I think, attempting to get about 53,000. I think that was the number that I saw as to the potential Afrikaner refugee status, being given green cards and so forth. But I think it'll be in the hundreds probably by the time the dust shakes out there.
And the future of Africa and South Africa, if this war continues, and it is a quagmire, the United States is thought it would be a quick war, in and out, and they'd overthrow the regime. If this war continues, the inflation rises internationally, and the oil continues to be shut down in the Hormuz. What would be the effect on Africa?
Well, the most important effect for the continent is, again, on food and fertilizers, the food prices already going up, but with the gas prices going up and actually availability problems, because on the east side, most of the oil would be coming from the Persian Gulf. But, you know, South Africa has a bit of oil coming from Nigeria and Angola on the west side, so that's not affected. And then I think defaults, we'll see, as we did in 2020 to 2023, as interest rates rose, especially when the Fed put them up in 2022, we saw the likes of Ethiopia and Ghana and Zambia declare bankruptcy. They couldn't pay their foreign loans, and that's quite inevitable. You know, the G20 was held here last November in Johannesburg, and it was meant to have as a major sort of point of measurement of its success the cancellation of African debt. If you recall, back in 2020, when COVID hit, then there was a very, very strong, a hit to the finances of African countries. And then there was a sort of delay on debt payments. Well, that ran out, and there's been no subsequent successes. And I think what we can say after the G20 last November is that South Africa's chair position actually led to a failure, because they put in charge a man, Trevor Manuel, who actually was himself in conflict of interest, because the institutions he works for, like Rothschild's Bank, also had high levels of portfolio debt. And so Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, got somebody comfortable from former finance minister from the elite classes, and they, of course, didn't really do anything at all about the African debt. So I'd say, yeah, more bankruptcies, more suffering. The states are really getting hollowed out. And in turn, I think, Steve, like we saw for the last half of last year, Kenya again in 2025 from June, July, again, Gen Z rises up, big protests. Then we saw it move to Zambia against a neoliberal president, and then Tunisia, where the trade unions were leaders. Then it moved over to Morocco, and then Madagascar. In the Madagascar case, an actual overthrow of a government. And then earlier this year, Tanzania. So these uprisings of protesters, mainly youth, and they really have little to lose. And in spite of intense repression, especially the Tanzanian government killing thousands earlier this year, we probably will see a fair bit more of these so-called IMF riots, where the IMF basically says get rid of the subsidies, or there's just no more money left in the fiscus to pay for basic state services. What I hope from that, Steve, will emerge, and we're trying to engage with leaders of movements from around the world, from our University of Johannesburg Center for Social Change, is some lessons in how you take IMF riots, that anger at having austerity, and make movements out of them. I think the most successful would have been the Brazilians in the 1980s, and when those debt crises occurred, and then you get Kutch, the big trade union, you get the movement of landless workers, you get community movements and social movements. And unfortunately, in most of the African continent, those IMF riots have had a sort of popcorn feature. They pop up and then they fall back without much left over. And I think that's going to be the challenge in the period ahead, is to make sure that as African uprisings occur, that they better link up, and that they have, like the Kenyans showed us really in June of 2024, that you can also link the problems. You're not just after your bad president, but you see the president's following IMF orders from Washington, and then you protest at the IMF. And those are the sorts of connectivities that I'm hoping organized labor will begin to also chime in on, because at this stage, when you've got an uprising in Africa, with the exception, as I say, of Tunisia and, of course, Egypt back in the Arab Spring, the North African uprisings, with those exceptions, labor has been a little bit more like a labor aristocracy, sitting around and not actually getting involved in the protests. It's hard to think of African workers in a labor aristocracy situation, but sometimes they are dedicated at that stage to the class snuggle instead of the class struggle. And yeah, our unions in South Africa are sometimes guilty of that.
That was University of Johannesburg political economist Patrick Bond speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
There have been various junctures. This will be a big one. When people try to figure out how it all unspun, there will be before and after the decapitation strike. Folks will reminisce about what the times were like. Before the straits were shut and the refineries destroyed, back when life, it seemed, was there to be enjoyed. Before the chaos that ensued, when the whole damn thing was hit by the wrecking ball of the man who would be king. As we're all longing for the times of yore, before the war.
That was AI Tsuno, written by David Rovics, Before the War. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. On Wednesday, March 25, 2026, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution introduced by Ghana's President John Dramani Mahama and the African Union, which recognizes the transatlantic slave trade as the, quote, gravest crime against humanity, end quote. The resolution, passed with 123 votes in favor, urges member states to apologize for slavery and supports the establishment of a reparations framework to address long-lasting, deep-seated racial injustice. Fahima Sek of WPFW in Washington, D.C., interviewed Dr. Nyaka Lagoki, Associate Professor of History and Pan-African Studies at Lincoln University. He is also Chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies.
Thank you, Dr. Lagoki, for agreeing to join us on Pacifica Radio today. Now, on this past Wednesday, a historic event took place. The UN approved and passed a historic resolution. Can you talk about the events and the things culminating up to that event?
Okay. Thank you very much, Fahima, for the opportunity. It was a great moment of pride for all of us that 123 countries voted in favor of the adoption of the resolution, which sought to make slavery as the gravest crime against humanity. 52 countries abstained. Many of them were countries of the European Union, including many of the countries, and England also was part of the countries that abstained. And three countries voted against: Argentina, Israel, and the United States of America. We have to understand that it is a culminating moment of all the processes that preceded the March 25th, 2026. Many groups of African people of African descent in the Americas, and then some in Africa, have been fighting for reparations for decades. We have the 1993 Abuja Declaration, a conference that was organized in Nigeria by Moshe Dabiola, who, by the way, ran for president in Nigeria. And then later on, we saw that there was the Durban Declaration and Program of Action after a conference that took place in South Africa in 2001. That declaration already recognized slavery as a crime against humanity, and that declaration already suggested and proposed the issue of reparation because of the enslavement of Africans.
Yes,
and then
I did have the opportunity to attend the Durban conference.
Okay, that was a great moment. So you can tell us more about that.
I just wanted to say that a couple of things came out of that. The People's Permanent Forum, the Permanent Forum People on African Descent, which had the UN had authorized, and they had been meeting with people, as you mentioned, from all over the world. But please continue.
Yeah. So, and then later on, like you said, the Permanent Forum of People of African Descent was put into place. And then there was a decade of the people of African descent from 2015 to 2024. And then the United Nations renewed that decade. And then from 2025 to 2034, it has the decade of people of African descent as adopted by the United Nations. In the meantime, CARICOM put into place a 10-point plan to how it sees the implementation of reparation for people of African descent. Several elements, one of them was about health, and some other elements about financial compensations. And now in Ghana, there was a conference that took place in 2023 in November. It was organized by Ghana and the African Union, and it was a major, major conference, and that conference led to the Accra Proclamation. Even if many of the things that were discussed did not appear in the proclamation, for instance, the issue of Pan-Africanism, and I was one of the people who spoke about it, the issue of the Ubuntu philosophy, I spoke about the Ubuntu. And then some other elements, and some other people spoke about a tribunal. But even if we did not see those elements, it was a turning point in the conversation about reparation. But before that, Ghana, under the leadership of the former president, Nana Akufo-Addo, launched the Year of Return 2019. And so, like you said, it is a build-up. And then when I had the opportunity to work as the chair of the scientific committee of the Non-Pan-African Congress, which was organized in Togo in December 2025, I made sure that the narrative of reparation be inserted in the documents and in the debates around and during the Non-Pan-African Congress. And then the pre-Congress that took place, of the Non-Pan-African Congress that took place in Salvador, Bahia, in Brazil, the topic was about reparation. So he came back to power, And then, of course, it builds on all the initiatives of people like you, people like Cam Howard, and many others, the leadership of CARICOM, and then people who try to do things in Africa. And he decided that he was going to submit a resolution to the UN so that slavery can be seen as the gravest crime against humanity, because there is a debate. There is that intention by those who believe in the might, that might is right, in America or in Israel, who wanted to present the Holocaust, which is a grave crime against humanity, but which lasted only 6 years, as the gravest crime against humanity, as we saw that in books and everywhere in the movies. And then that's why the resolution passed by John Mahama Dramani is a very important element, a moment in the history of Africa, in the history of the world, and the history of Africa and its people.
I know that there are reparations commissions in various parts of the country. There's one in New York City. There was one in California, Fulton County, in Georgia, here in Washington, D.C., and various Chicago and various places. I believe that this will buttress their efforts and allow them to continue to do that work in the call for restitution and reparations. Where does the common individual, because we're all celebrating and we're happy, what can we do to advance this struggle?
Yes, we are celebrating. We are happy. It's a great moment. But it, for me, it is just the beginning of the second phase of the struggle. Because one of the things that I've noticed, it is only in recent years that we saw a united front around the conference in Ghana in November 23, that we saw the formation of a united front between CARICOM and the African Union. A real one, the real united front started before what we saw in recent years. But one thing is that many of the groups, I'm going to talk about the Commission for Repression in the United States that you mentioned in a few, but one of the things that I've noticed is that people who are talking about repression or who are talking about the crimes committed by the white supremacists, it looks like they're not doing the work in coordination as they should. For instance, we don't hear much about the double debt of Haiti. And then when the Haitians are talking about the double debt, we do not hear them talk about the campaign against nuclear imperialism in Algeria. And the French, during the colonial time, they had tried to test the nuclear bombs in the desert of Algeria while the Algerians waged an armed struggle to be free. So you can see from Haiti to Algeria. And then when you go to Senegal, I was lucky, I've been part of all those conversations. When you go to Senegal over there, they don't talk too much about the suffering of African Americans. They don't talk about the suffering of the Afro-Caribbeans. They focus solely, most of the time, on the Tiaroy camp massacre, which happened on December 1st, 1944. Then you go to from Senegal, you go to Namibia, and then we don't see those who are seeking repression from the Germans. I'll talk about the massacre of the Namas and the Hereros. Their struggles seem not to be linked to the global conversation about repression. Same thing in South Africa. Over there, they talk about land restitution, but the South Africans are not part of the global conversation about repression. So I can talk about Togo. The first president of Togo, Sylvanus Olympio, was obliged, when his country became independent, he was obliged to pay some compensation to the French because they said that they lost money after the independence of Togo. So I have just given you the picture of what is going on in the Pan-African world about the issue of reparation. But what somebody like me, what I want to see a real gathering where we can see, we can hear the voices coming from different corners of the Pan-African world, so that we can think about how to build a sustainable united front for reparation. Same thing here. All those groups are working from time to time. They meet, but as I think there should be a national commission that is going to take into account, the needs and the works, and then of all the debates of all those commissions that people created. Even though I know they do some work together, but I'm talking about something permanent, sustainable, that can also be a stronger voice in all those people who are fighting for repression in the United States.
That was Fahima Sek of WPFW in Washington, D.C., in conversation with Dr. Nyaka Lagoki, Associate Professor of History and Pan-African Studies at Lincoln University. Dr. Lagoki is also Chair of Lincoln's Department of Pan-African Studies.
I'm going back to the South. I'm going back, 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 where my roots ain't watered down. Growing, growing like a baobab tree, all life on fertile ground. My ancestor put me on game, long time on gold chains, with my old shoon energy. Drip all on me. Ankara dashiki friend. Hola, donuts, sunlight, sacha, nut, chapa, incense. Yeah, pure ice, 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 ice. Bust down, bloody. Bloody, bloody, put my wrist out.
That was Beyoncé, Black Parade. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Ertuğrul Kürkçü is a former member of the parliament in Turkey, representing the Peace and Democracy Party, and is presently an honorary member of the People's Democratic Party, or HDP. He's facing arrest by the Erdogan government for supporting the struggle of the Kurdish people. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the effect of the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran and the escalating war in the region.
I can say that American war on Iran has been strongly rebuffed by Turkey and Turkey's neighbors in general. We see that Russia and the United States are at odds in almost every point about the Middle East. Turkey was a NATO ally and a strong, staunch supporter of Trump, particularly on the Syrian issue. However, the attack on Iran has resulted with a distancing of the Turkish regime from the United States for two reasons. One of them is that a destabilization in Iran is something scary for the Turkish establishment, because it's a new source of secession, particularly for non-Persian ethnicities in Iran. This is one of the basic fears that the Turkish establishment is keeping a distance from the American assault on Iran. The second thing is that increased the initiative and power of Israel, and Turkey and Israel are competing for regional hegemony, and Israel's rise is not a good news for Turkey, although Turkey is on the same side globally in NATO with the United States and Europe. But we are at a moment when the interests of the capitalist imperialist powers are in differentiating. The European approach and American approach is somehow different. And Turkey is now seeking a midman's role to bring all the warring parties together in Ukraine, in Iran, in Gaza. So this gives Tayyip Erdogan an upper hand for presenting himself a kind of a peace broker. But as far as I can understand, that the United States at this moment does not need peace brokers. They are desperately in need of alliances, and they just have only the Gulf Emirates on their side and no one else in the world. Therefore, Turkey is now not being practically involved in the American war. In the first Gulf War and during the invasion of Iraq, Turkey was somehow in alliance with the United States, but this time not. Secondly, the Kurdish movement has distanced itself from the United States, particularly after the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, because the United States have been supporting the Ahmed al-Shara regime, which is staunchly Arabic nationalist, fundamental Islamist. Therefore, this is in total confrontation with the Kurdish gains in Syria. Therefore, Kurds are now very prudent in going in the same direction with the United States, even if they do not declare the United States as an enemy, but they are very much in doubt that America can be a friend from now on. Therefore, the Kurdish forces have signaled that they are not going to be part of the American assault on Iran, and they have recommended their comrades in Iran to protect their security and safety, but they will not be part of the war. They declared that we are not on any side. We are neither for the Islamic Republic nor for the United States, and Iran is going to gain its future, decide its future by itself. Therefore, Kurds are now looking for increased, bigger rights for them in four parts of Kurdistan, in Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. Therefore, I can say that the United States has not been able to find a staunch ally, neither in the Turkish government nor in the Kurdish opposition. This is where America has lost a lot of credibility. However, since Turkey is a part of NATO, and as long as Turkey is obliged to line up with the general direction of NATO, it's obvious that Turkey is not going to be on Iran's side, but it's going to be an inner dissent in the NATO. This is it. On the other hand, the economic impacts of the Iran war is daily affecting the affordability crisis in Turkey. Turkey is very much dependent on oil coming from Iran and from Gulf sources. And now production costs for Turkish economy is daily growing, and this is adding to the already ongoing inflation and the affordability crisis in Turkey. I don't think that Turkey may be able to continue the present status quo in the, let's say, coming 3 or 6 months, particularly in the economic dimension. And therefore, everybody in Turkey, as far as I can follow from afar, is eager to find an immediate solution to the ongoing conflict. And but this immediate solution depends on 2 things: the resilience of Iran and the weakness of Trump regime. So. Part of the issue now belongs to the American people. If they stop Trump, the war stops. And I'm very hopeful on that point because I see the growing dissent against war in the United States also. This is a brief summary of what things look like from our perspective.
And of course, the United States has been intervening for decades, many decades in the Middle East. And the biggest invasion, one of the biggest invasions before Afghanistan was Iraq, with the plan of taking over Iraq, grabbing the oil in Iraq, and for Israel making one less threat to their expansion. And the breakup of Iraq, that plan was to divide up so it was weak. And in fact, there were Turkish bases there. Countries were intervening in Iraq and were still there. The United States is now facing a situation in the Middle East where its bases are being attacked throughout the Middle East. It's having to leave. Isn't this expansion of the war in Iran going to escalate the decline of the United States in the Middle East?
It looks like, because what we see is that the United States had made a big mistake in calculating the capacities of Iran and the dimension of its, the depth of its resilience. They were expecting a short war, but it's now prolonging and prolonging and prolonging. And now we see that Iran is capable of striking the U.S. bases across the Gulf and even far behind that. You know, the missiles have been now coming over, have been passing over Turkey. This is kind of a signal, you know, that look how long is our arm, and the generals and the political leaders are observing how long Iran's arm may be. And therefore, even NATO members are now resisting against Trump's calls to side with the United States for controlling the Hormuz Strait and the Gulf in general, and the NATO, the European NATO members practically said that this is not our war, this is your war. This is not a NATO war, this is an American war. So, and America is not under attack, it is attacking, so we have no obligations. And this is also true for the Gulf countries, because Gulf states, because Iran is conditioning its behavior with supporting the United States bases or not. If you send the bases out, we are okay. This is a very dramatic point for the Gulf states because America is too far, you know. Iran is too close. For your neighbors, you cannot, you know, start a war for transatlantic interests. Therefore, yes, you're right. Both politically, historically, logically, and militarily, America is declining in Middle East, and the I understand that Trump's understanding of imperialism is very much different than the sophisticated precedents that he had in the past. He never understood why do we need to have hegemony? We have force, so we can break every door which is closed. But there was an imperialist logic what Trump is missing now. So I wouldn't say that I would prefer the you know, more sophisticated ones, because Trump is giving us the naked appearance of what imperialism is in a sense. So maybe Trump is going to be one of the reasons why this war is going to be lost by the United States. However, we must not forget that America's capabilities are still very high, and we have to take everything very seriously, because Trump is only the scum of American imperialism. It's something much deeper, much organized, and has a historical heritage. Therefore, we must look for a new civilization, I think, that after this war and after this Trump era, we have to have a new plan for the world, because the old system has also collapsed, that the post-Second World War status quo has collapsed. So we have to rebuild a new world order, and this is a very huge issue. Not you know, stopping the war is something, but stopping the or ending the war capabilities is much more important for us. So still we need a revolution, this way or that way.
And of course, the role of not just American imperialism, but British imperialism with the Balfour Agreement, the divisions, the dividing up of the Middle East by imperialist powers. Yeah. For exploitation. That is part of the history of the Middle East, and the history, for that matter, of the world, of Asia, of Africa. And now this war threatens to break up that whole relationship. The Gulf states, which were set up by the United States, supported these theocratic reactionary states that Trump loves to make deals with, him and his family. Now this may be threatened by the collapse of these states, where most of the workers are migrants. Migrant workers represent the majority of workers in the Gulf states. So aren't there very
great
for American imperialism revolutionary implications of people of the Middle East starting to realize they have the power and they have to get rid of a system which is based on imperialism, based on exploitation of their resources by U.S. and European capitals?
Yes. You're right. All the Gulf states are somehow, I would say that not you know, underestimating the reality of the life in those states, but the present you know, glory of those emirates is something superficial. It's not an organic growth of a social economy. It's something else. So we see that in 3 weeks, now they don't have drinking water, because everything is you know, provided by oil, which is transformed into gold. This is not the organic way of you know, social growth. Therefore, this creates a very unstable situation. And when this unstable situation comes to an end, we are going to have a bizarre society where the labor is represented by foreigners, and the power is lost by the locals who don't have any relation, neither to their people nor the foreign workers. So it's going to be something very new for an international struggle for the rights of labor. This is something very new. I cannot imagine looking at Turkey. If, let's say, the working class Bangladeshi and the ruling class was Turks or cosmopolitan people, and what would the Bangladeshi do when the economy collapsed? Of course, Turkey is a very big and deep country. That is not a good example. But on the, I really am very curious how the social struggles would develop when those regimes were facing collapse. This is something totally new, and this is not written in any book. So capital is not enough to analyze this situation.
And the Erdogan government, one of the things that they proclaimed is that they wanted to rebuild Turkey similar to the Ottoman Empire, and that they would expand and they would become a great force in the Middle East, independent force. And in that goal, they wanted to recruit the Kurds to support them in this endeavor. And why don't you talk about the implications of that and the reality of that and where the Kurdish people are in relationship to Erdogan's goal of expanding Turkey and for the Kurds to be part of that expansion?
Yeah. Actually, Turkey does not have as much influence as they expect on Kurds of Iraq, Iran, and Syria. Yes, they have some influence on the Kurds in Turkey. Some of them, or half of them, are voting for the AKP, but the other half is fighting for social change. In order to strike a deal with the Kurds for future, a social dimension, national dimension, and political dimension should be met. I see no project for the Turkish government in this direction. However, Kurds now laid down arms, and this is their right to decide by which methods they would fight for their rights. But they didn't lay down their aspirations and hopes for a free life for Kurds and for Turks altogether. Therefore, there is still a great discrepancy between the Kurdish people's aspirations, Kurdish leadership's concerns, and Turkey's elite's targets. On the other hand, this neo-Ottomanism is not a concrete project, but this kind of propaganda, motive of propaganda for encouraging the people to continue support the Erdogan regime. However, we keep in mind that the redivision of the globe between big powers has some limits. Turkey has its limits, Russia, United States, China, Europe, and the local powers, India, Pakistan, Iran, and the Arab countries have also their aspirations. So this doesn't provide a Lebensraum, in Hitler's terms, for the Turkish rulers. Territorial gains are not something that may happen in the visible future.
That was Ertuğrul Kürkçü, a former member of the parliament in Turkey and an honorary member of the People's Democratic Party, HDP. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and Fahima Sek. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.